chain, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, did, and they developed Fleming's observation into the first wonder drug. It was so scarce and so powerful that in World War II, U.S. Army teams recovered it from the urine of men who had been treated with it, so it could be reused. In 1945, Florey, Chain, and Fleming shared the Nobel Prize. In 1929, at a major conference on influenza, Welch gave his personal assessment. "Personally, I do feel there is very little evidence that B. influenzae can be the cause. But when such leading investigators as Dr. Opie, for example, feel that the evidence is altogether in favor of Pfeiffer's, and take the further exasperating position that the failure of other bacteriologists to find it was due to error in technique, to lack of skill, one cannot say there is not room for further investigation. The fact has always appealed to me that influenza is possibly an infection due to an unknown virus, with this extraordinary effect of reducing the resistance so that the body, at least the respiratory tract, becomes such that any organisms are able to invade and produce acute respiratory trouble and pneumonia." In 1931, Pfeiffer himself still argued that, of all organisms yet described, the pathogen he had called Bacillus influenzae, and that informally bore his name, had the best claim to serious consideration as the primary etiologic agent, and its only competition is an unidentified, filterable virus. Avery continued to work on the influenza bacillus for several years after the pandemic. As his protege René Dubos said, his scientific problems were almost forced on him by his social environment. By that, he meant that the Rockefeller Institute influenced his choice of problems. If something mattered to Flexner and Cole, Avery worked on it. And he made remarkable progress, proving that passage in animals did make the bacillus more lethal and, far more importantly, isolating the factors in blood that B. influenzae needed to grow, initially identifying them as X and V. It was extraordinary work, work that marked a milestone in understanding the nutritional needs and metabolism of all bacteria. But as the likelihood of the influenza bacillus causing influenza began to fade, the pressure on him to work on it faded also. Although he had initially inclined toward the view that it caused influenza, he became one of the increasing number of scientists who believed B. influenzae had been misnamed. He had no inherent interest in the organism and had never abandoned his work on the pneumococcus. Far from it. And the epidemic had driven home more than ever the lethal nature of pneumonia. Pneumonia had done the killing. It remained the captain of the men of death. Pneumonia was the target. He returned to his work on the pneumococcus full-time. He would study it for the rest of his scientific life. In fact, as first months and then years passed, Avery seemed to limit his entire world to the research he himself engaged in. He had always focused. Now his focus tightened. Even Dubois said, "I was often surprised and at times almost shocked by the fact that his range of scientific information was not as broad as could have been assumed from his fame and from the variety and magnitude of his scientific achievement." Another time, Dubois observed, "He made little effort to follow modern trends in science or other intellectual fields, but instead focused his attention on subjects directly related to the precise problem he had under study. In the lab, he was limited to a rather narrow range of techniques, which he rarely changed and to which he added little." His interests increasingly narrowed to one interest, the one thing he was trying to comprehend, the pneumococcus. It was as if his mind became not only a filter, but a funnel that concentrated all the light and information in all the world on one point only. And at the bottom of this funnel, he did not simply sit, sifting through data. He used its edges to dig deeper and deeper into the earth, tunneling so deep that the only light present was that which he carried with him. He could see nothing but what lay before him. And more, he began to narrow his focus even further, to a single aspect of the pneumococcus, to the polysaccharide capsule, the M&M-like sugar shell surrounding it. The immune system had great difficulty attacking pneumococci surrounded by capsules. Encapsulated pneumococci grew rapidly and unimpeded in the lungs. They killed. Pneumococci without capsules were not virulent. The immune system easily destroyed them. At the lunch tables at the Institute, sitting in the comfortable chairs, pulling apart baguettes of French bread, drinking an endless supply of coffee, scientists learned from each other. The tables were of eight, but usually one senior person would dominate a discussion. Avery spoke little, even as he grew in stature and seniority. Yet he dominated in his own way, asking pointed questions about problems that confronted him, searching for any ideas that might help. Constantly he tried to recruit people whose knowledge complemented his own. He wanted a biochemist, and, beginning in 1921, over and over he tried to lure Michael Heidelberger, a brilliant young biochemist, away from the laboratory of Nobel laureate Carl Landsteiner. Heidelberger recalled, "Avery would come upstairs from his lab and show me a little vial of dirty-looking dark gray stuff and say, 'See, my boy, the whole secret of bacterial specificity is in this little vial. When are you going to work on it?'" Inside the vial were dissolved capsules. Avery had isolated the material from the blood and urine of pneumonia patients. He believed that it held the secret to using the immune system to defeat pneumonia. If he could find that secret. Eventually, Heidelberger did join Avery. So did others. And Avery settled into an unchanging routine. He lived on East 67th Street, and his laboratory was on 66th in York. Every morning he walked in at the same time wearing what seemed the same gray jacket, took the elevator to his sixth floor office, and traded the jacket for a light tan lab coat. Only if he was doing something unusual, if there was a special occasion, would he ever wear a white lab coat. But there was nothing routine in this work. He conducted most experiments at the lab benches, actually wooden desks originally designed for an office. His equipment remained simple, almost primitive. Avery disliked gadgetry. When he experimented, remembered a colleague, he was intensely focused. His movements were limited, but of extreme precision and elegance. His whole being appeared to be identified with the sharply defined aspect of the reality that he was studying. Confusions seemed to vanish, perhaps simply because everything seemed so organized around his person. Each experiment created its own world, with possibilities for joy and despair. He would leave cultures in an incubator overnight, and each morning he and his young colleagues would converge on the incubator, not knowing what they would find. Quiet as he was, reserved as he was always tense then, his expression simultaneously eager and fearful. In 1923, he and Heidelberger turned the scientific world on its head by proving that the capsules did generate an immune response. The capsules were pure carbohydrate. Until then, investigators had believed that only a protein or something containing proteins could stimulate the immune system to respond. The finding only spurred Avery and his colleagues on. More than ever, he concentrated on the capsule, forsaking practically everything else. He believed it to be the key to the specific reaction of the immune system, the key to making an effective therapy or vaccine, the key to killing the killer. And he believed that much of what he discovered about the pneumococcus would be applicable to all bacteria. Then, in 1928, Fred Griffith in Britain published a striking and puzzling finding. Earlier, Griffith had discovered that all known types of pneumococci could exist with or without capsules. Virulent pneumococci had capsules. Pneumococci without capsules could be easily destroyed by the immune system. Now he found something much stranger. He killed virulent pneumococci, ones surrounded by capsules, and injected them into mice. Since the bacteria were dead, all the mice survived. He also injected living pneumococci that had no capsules, that were not virulent. Again, the mice lived. Their immune systems devoured the unencapsulated pneumococci. But then he injected dead pneumococci surrounded by capsules and living pneumococci without capsules. The mice died. Somehow, the living pneumococci had acquired capsules. Somehow, they had changed. And, when isolated from the mice, they continued to grow with the capsule, as if they had inherited it. Griffith's report seemed to make meaningless years of Avery's work and life. The immune system was based on specificity. Avery believed that the capsule was key to that specificity. But if the pneumococcus could change, that seemed to undermine everything Avery believed and thought he had proved. For months, he dismissed Griffith's work as unsound. But Avery's despair seemed overwhelming. He left the laboratory for 6 months, suffering from Graves' disease, a disease likely related to stress. By the time he returned, Michael Dawson, a junior colleague he had asked to check Griffith's results, had confirmed them. Avery had to accept them. His work now turned in a different direction. He had to understand how one kind of pneumococcus was transformed into another. He was now almost 60 years old. Thomas Huxley said, "A man of science past 60 does more harm than good." But now, more than ever, Avery focused on his task. In 1931, Dawson, then at Columbia University but still working closely with Avery, and an assistant succeeded in changing, in a test tube, a pneumococcus that lacked a capsule into one that had a capsule. The next year, people in Avery's own laboratory managed to use a cell-free extract from dead, encapsulated pneumococci to do the same thing, to make bacteria without capsules change into ones with capsules. One after another, the young scientists in his laboratory moved on. Avery kept on. By the late 1930s, he was working with Colin McLeod and Macklin McCarty, and they now turned all their energies to understanding how this happened. If Avery had demanded precision before, now he demanded virtual perfection, irrefutability. They grew huge amounts of virulent type 3 pneumococci and spent not just hours or days, but months and years breaking the bacteria down, looking at each constituent part, trying to understand. The work was of the utmost tedium, and it was work that yielded failure after failure after failure after failure. Avery's name was appearing on fewer and fewer papers. Much of that was because he put his name on papers of people in his laboratory only if he had physically performed an experiment included in the research the paper detailed, no matter how much he had contributed conceptually to the work, or how often he had talked over ideas with the investigator. This was highly generous of Avery. Usually a laboratory chief puts his or her name on virtually every paper anyone in his laboratory writes. Dubow recalled that he worked under Avery for 14 years, that Avery influenced nearly all his work, but only 4 times did Avery's name appear on his papers. Another young investigator said, "I had always felt so deeply that I was an associate of Avery that with great astonishment I realized for the first time that we had never published a joint paper." But Avery was also publishing less because he had little to report. The work was extraordinarily difficult, pushing the limits of the technically possible. "Disappointment is my daily bread," he had said. "I thrive on it." But he did not thrive. Often he thought of abandoning the work, abandoning all of it. Yet every day he continued to fill nearly every waking hour with thinking about it. Between 1934 and 1941, he published nothing. Nothing. For a scientist to go through such a dry period is more than depressing. It is a refutation of one's abilities, of one's life. But in the midst of that dry spell, Avery told a young researcher there were 2 types of investigators. "Most go around picking up surface nuggets, and whenever they can spot a surface nugget of gold, they pick it up and add it to their collection. The other type is not really interested in the surface nugget. He is much more interested in digging a deep hole in one place, hoping to hit a vein. And of course, if he strikes a vein of gold, he makes a tremendous advance. By 1940, he had gone deep enough to believe he would find something. Something of value. Between 1941 and 1944, he again published nothing. But now it was different. Now what he was working on excited him as nothing else had. He was gaining confidence that he would reach his destination. Heidelberger recalled, Avery would come and talk about his work on the transforming substance. There was something that told him that this transforming substance was something really fundamental to biology, to the understanding of life itself. Avery loved an Arab saying, "The dogs bark, the caravan moves on." He had nothing to publish because his work was being done chiefly by subtraction. But it was moving on. He had isolated whatever transformed the pneumococcus. Now he was analyzing that substance by eliminating one possibility after another. First, he eliminated proteins. Enzymes that deactivated proteins had no effect on the substance. Then he eliminated lipids, fatty acids. Other enzymes that destroyed lipids had no effect on the ability of this substance to transform pneumococci. He eliminated carbohydrates. What he had left was rich in nucleic acids, but an enzyme isolated by Dubow that destroys ribonucleic acid had no effect on the transforming substance either. Each of these steps had taken months or years, but he could see it now. In 1943, he nominally retired and became an emeritus member of the Institute. His retirement changed nothing. He worked exactly as he always had, experimenting, pushing, tightening. That year, he wrote his younger brother, a physician, about extraordinary findings and in April informed the Institute's Board of Scientific Directors. His findings would revolutionize all biology, and his evidence seemed beyond solid. Other scientists who had found what he had found would have published already. Still, he would not publish. One of his junior colleagues asked, "Fess, what more do you want?" But he had been burned so long ago in that very first work at Rockefeller, when he had published a sweeping theory encompassing bacterial metabolism, virulence, and immunity. He had been wrong, and he never forgot the humiliation. He did more work. Then, finally, in November 1943, he, McLeod, and McCarty submitted a paper titled "Studies on the Chemical Nature of the Substance Inducing Transformation of Pneumococcal Types, Induction of Transformation by a Desoxyribonucleic Acid Fraction Isolated from Pneumococcus Type 3 to the Journal of Experimental Medicine, the journal founded by Welch. In February 1944, the journal published the paper. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, had been isolated in the late 1860s by a Swiss investigator. No one knew its function. Geneticists ignored it. The molecule seemed far too simple to have anything to do with genes or heredity. Geneticists believed that proteins, which are far more complex molecules, carried the genetic code. Avery, McLeod, and McCarty wrote, "The inducing substance has been likened to a gene, and the capsular antigen which is produced in response to it has been regarded as a gene product." Avery had found that the substance that transformed a pneumococcus from one without a capsule to one with a capsule was DNA. Once the pneumococcus changed, its progeny inherited the change. He had demonstrated that DNA carried genetic information, that genes lay within DNA. His experiments were exquisite, elegant, and irrefutable. A Rockefeller colleague conducted confirming experiments on Pfeiffer's B. influenzae. Among historians of science, there has been some controversy over how much immediate impact Avery's paper had, largely because one geneticist, Gunther Stent, wrote that it had little influence on thought about the mechanisms of heredity for the next 8 years. and Avery's conclusions were not immediately accepted as true by the broad scientific community. But they were accepted as true by the scientists who mattered. Prior to Avery's discovery and proof that DNA carried the genetic code, he was being seriously considered for the Nobel Prize for his lifetime of contributions to knowledge of immunochemistry. But then came his revolutionary paper. Instead of guaranteeing him the prize, the Nobel Committee found it too revolutionary, too startling. A prize would endorse his findings, and the committee would take no such risk, not until others confirmed them. The official history of the organization that gives the prize states, "Those results were obviously of fundamental importance, but the Nobel Committee found it desirable to wait until more became known." Others were determined to make more known. James Watson, with Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, wrote in his classic The Double Helix that there was general acceptance that genes were special types of protein molecules, until Avery showed that hereditary traits could be transmitted from one bacterial cell to another by purified DNA molecules. Avery's experiments strongly suggested that future experiments would show that all genes were composed of DNA. Avery's experiment made DNA smell like the essential genetic material. Of course, there were scientists who thought the evidence favoring DNA was inconclusive and preferred to believe that genes were protein molecules. Francis, however, did not worry about these skeptics. Many were cantankerous fools who always backed the wrong horses. Not only narrow-minded and dull, but also just stupid. Watson and Crick were not the only investigators seeking the great prize, the greatest prize, the key to heredity and possibly to life, who immediately grasped the significance of Avery's work. Erwin Chargaff, a chemist whose findings were crucial to Watson and Crick's understanding enough about the DNA molecule to determine its structure, said, "Avery gave us the first text of a new language, or rather, he showed us where to look for it. I resolved to search for this text." Max Delbruck, who was trying to use viruses to understand heredity, said, "He was very attentive to what we were doing, and we were very attentive to what he was doing. It was obvious that he had something interesting there." Salvador Luria, who worked with Delbruck, Watson was a graduate student under him, similarly rejected Stent's contention that Avery's findings were ignored. Luria recalled having lunch with Avery at the Rockefeller Institute and discussing the implications of his work with him. "I think it is complete nonsense to say that we were not aware." Peter Medawar observed, "The dark ages of DNA came to an end in 1944 with Avery." Medawar called the work the most interesting and portentous biological experiment of the 20th century. McFarlane Burnett was, like Avery, studying infectious diseases, not genes, but in 1943 he visited Avery's laboratory and left astounded. Avery, he said, was doing nothing less than the isolation of a pure gene in the form of desoxyribonucleic acid. In fact, what Avery accomplished was a classic of basic science. He started his search looking for a cure for pneumonia and ended up, as Burnett observed, opening the field of molecular biology. Watson, Crick, Delbruck, Luria, Medawar, and Burnett all won the Nobel Prize. Avery never did. Rockefeller University, the former Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, did name a gate after him, the only such honor accorded to anyone. And the National Library of Medicine has produced a series of online profiles of prominent scientists. It made Avery the first to be so honored. Oswald Avery was 67 years old when he published his paper on the transforming principle. He died 11 years later in 1955, 2 years after Watson and Crick unfolded DNA's structure. He died in Nashville, where he had gone to live to be near his brother, his family. Dubow compared his death to that of Welch in 1934, and quoted Simon Flexner on Welch's exit from the stage. "While his body suffered, His mind struggled to maintain before the world the same placid exterior that had been his banner and his shield. Popsy, the physician who had been so greatly beloved, died as he had lived, keeping his own counsel and essentially alone. Chapter 36. In the first years after the pandemic, Paul Lewis continued to head the Henry Phipps Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. Yet Lewis was not a happy man. He was one of those who continued to believe that B. influenzae caused the disease and continued to work on it after the epidemic passed. There was irony in that, since he had initially been reluctant to embrace its etiological role, suspecting instead a filterable virus. Perhaps the chief reason for his stubbornness was his own experience. He had not only found the bacillus with consistency, but he had produced a vaccine that seemed to work. True, the Navy had administered a vaccine prepared according to his methods to several thousand men, and it had proven ineffective. But he had not made that vaccine himself. A smaller batch that he had personally prepared and tested, during the peak of the epidemic, not in its later stages when many vaccines seemed to be working only because the disease itself was weakening, had given solid evidence of effectiveness. Only 3 of 60 people who received the vaccine developed pneumonia, and none died. A control group had 10 pneumonias and 3 deaths. Those results deceived him. In the past, he had not always made the right scientific judgment. No investigator does. But this may have been his first significant scientific error, and it seemed to mark the beginning of a downhill slope for him. That was not obvious at first. He had already built an international reputation. The German scientific journal Zeitschrift für Tuberkulose translated and reprinted his work. In 1917, he was invited to give the annual Harvey Lecture on Tuberculosis, a great honor. Rufus Cole, for example, would not receive that invitation for another decade. 85 years later, Dr. David Lewis Aronson, a scientist, whose father, a prize-winning scientist, had worked in the best European laboratories and considered Lewis the smartest man he ever met and gave his son Lewis's name, recalled reading that speech. You could see Lewis's mind working, the depth of it, and vision, going well beyond what was going on at the time. Lewis's views had broadened indeed. His interests now included mathematics and biophysics, and, with no resources of his own, he asked Flexner to arrange for the support of a physicist Lewis wanted to lure into medicine to examine fluorescent dyes and the disinfectant power of light and the penetrating power of light for animal tissues. Flexner did so, and Flexner continued to be impressed by Lewis's own work, replying by return mail when Lewis sent him a paper, saying that he would publish it in the Journal of Experimental Medicine, calling it interesting and important. Yet Lewis's life after the war began pulling him away from the laboratory, frustrating him. Henry Phipps, the U.S. steel magnate who had given his name to the institute Lewis headed, had not endowed it generously. Lewis's own salary had risen well enough, from $3,500 a year when he started in 1910 to $5,000 just before the war. Flexner still considered him vastly underpaid and saw to it that immediately after the war, the University of California at Berkeley offered him a professorship. Lewis declined, but Penn raised his salary to $6,000, a substantial income at that time. But if his own salary was more than adequate, he needed to fund an entire institute, even if a small one. He needed money for centrifuges, glassware, heating, not to mention deaners, the word still in use for technicians and young scientists. He needed to raise the money for all that himself. As a result, Lewis more and more found himself drawn into the social milieu of Philadelphia, raising money, being charming. More and more, he was becoming a salesman, selling both the institute and himself. He hated it. He hated the time it took from the laboratory, the drain of his energies, the parties. And the country was in the midst of a deep recession, with 4 million soldiers suddenly thrown back onto the job market, with the government no longer building ships and tanks, with Europe desolate and unable to buy anything. Raising money was more than just difficult. In 1921, the University of Iowa approached him. They wanted to become a first-class research institution, and they wanted him to run the program, to build the institution. The state would supply the money. Flexner was more than just a mentor to Lewis, and Lewis confided in him that the Iowa job seemed heavy, safe, and of limited inspiration. "You know very well that I do not thrive on routine. And at Phipps, some of the work underway has great potential, I believe. You will see that I am trying to convince myself that I have a right to gamble here as against a rather dull, safe outlook at Iowa City. A word from you would be much appreciated." Flexner advised him to accept the offer. "All I have heard of the medical situation at Iowa City is favorable. A pretty sharp contrast to the situation in Philadelphia. It is definite and has the elements of permanency. I have no doubt under the influence of your vigorous guidance, the department, although quite large, over which you would preside would become so notable that the state would stand back of you in any enlargement." He did not tell Lewis how well he thought the job might suit him, how extraordinary his gifts for a job like that were. But Flexner did tell a senior colleague that Lewis might really come to exercise a real influence in medical teaching and research. There was perhaps some of what Welch had in him, that Lewis had quite unusual gifts of exposition. He had broad knowledge. Perhaps he even leaked knowledge, and whether he realized it or not, he could inspire. Indeed, Flexner believed he could be master of the field. The University of Pennsylvania countered the offer. It gave him a new title, raised his salary to $8,000, guaranteed it for 5 years, and guaranteed funding for the institute itself for 2 years. He stayed. "Flexner congratulated you and the university especially on your new honor. Will the new chair add to your university responsibility?" It would. Partly for that reason, Lewis remained restless. He had rejected the Iowa position because, though it might allow him to build a major institution, it would keep him out of the laboratory. Now he found himself in much the same situation at Penn. He detested maneuvering with or around deans, and he continued to play the role of social creature. Scientists were the new thing, Faustian figures able to create worlds and fashionable to show off on the main line. Lewis hated being shown off. There was tension at home with his wife as well. How much of that came from his research frustrations? How much because his wife liked the Philadelphia society that he wanted no part of, how much because his wife simply wanted more of him, it is impossible to know. One research project in particular seemed to be going well, and he wanted to attend to it and give up everything else. He envied not only Avery's ability to concentrate on one thing, but also his opportunity to do so. For Lewis, everything seemed to press upon him. Indeed, everything seemed ready to explode. In 1922, Iowa offered him the position again. This time, he accepted. He felt a responsibility to leave Phipps in good shape and recruited Eugene Opie from Washington University to replace him. Opie had, if anything, an even greater reputation than his own. Flexner had always respected Lewis, yet there had always been a gap between them. They had been getting closer. At one point, Flexner wrote him, "Sometime do let me take a little trouble for you." Lewis confided in return, "You have stood in the light of father to me." Now, when Opie agreed to replace Lewis at Phipps, Flexner seemed to see Lewis in a new light. Capable not only as a scientist, but as someone who could play another game well, telling him, "Opie surprised me. I supposed him a fixture in St. Louis. If you prepared the way for so good a man at the Phipps Institute, you may well feel gratified." Lewis did not feel gratified. He remained restless and discontented. What he really wanted was to be shut of everything, everything except the laboratory. Perhaps without quite realizing it, he had been moving toward a crisis. Again, he told Flexner that what he really wanted more than anything was to work at his laboratory bench. He was shut of Philadelphia. Now, he had to get himself shut of Iowa. In January 1923, he wrote Flexner, "It is quite clear to me today that I am entitled again for a short time at least to cultivate my personal interests. I am giving up my place here and all of my plans for a future in Philadelphia. I have written to President Jessup of the University of Iowa, telling him of my change of plan and that that is also in the discard. I am going to try my best to develop the opportunity for a year of study in some place as far removed from any question of affairs or position as possible. I cannot make it too plain that for the coming year I am seeking no position in the conventional sense of the word. What I really want is the rehabilitation of a more or less vacant mind." He was quitting everything, walking away from position, prestige, and money, walking into the wilderness with no guarantee of anything, stripping himself naked at the age of 44 with a wife and two children. He was free. Where he had been happiest in his life, where he had done the best science, had been at the Rockefeller Institute. The Institute had created a division of animal pathology in Princeton, close to Philadelphia. Theobald Smith, the same man who had rejected Welch's offer to become the first head of the Rockefeller Institute itself, had left Harvard and now headed this division. Smith had also been Lewis's first mentor and had recommended him so many years before to Flexner. Lewis explored with Smith the possibility of going to Princeton. Smith first wanted assurances that Lewis wanted to go to work again and that all this advertising business had not gone to his head. Lewis eagerly gave them. Flexner had urged him to take the Iowa job, but replied, "I shall be rejoiced to see you return to the lab where you so naturally belong and in which you will do your best, most lasting and effective work. It seems to me a crying pity that men who have given years to the necessary preparation for a lab career should be so ruthlessly drawn away from it and made to fill executive positions." He also told Lewis that Smith was very pleased with the prospect of having you associated with him again. Lewis asked for no salary whatsoever, just full access to the laboratories for a year. Flexner gave him $8,000, his salary at Phipps, and a budget for laboratory equipment, filing cabinets, 540 animal cages for breeding and experimenting, and three assistants. He told Lewis he would expect nothing whatsoever from him for the year, and then they could talk again about the future. Lewis was ecstatic. "To start with Dr. Smith again on any possible basis takes me back to 1905, on, I hope, certainly a new higher level. You will not find me lacking in effort. I am most fortunate and happy in being able to regard myself as entirely in the hands of you two men who, without distinction and accepting only my parents, have given me the means and the education and the direction. Few have such a chance to renew their youth. My only hope is that I continue to deserve your confidence." Princeton then was still surrounded by farms and countryside. It was peaceful, almost bucolic. The Rockefeller facility was not far from the campus of Princeton University, which was still transforming itself from the finishing school for gentlemen that F. Scott Fitzgerald described to the intellectual center that it would not fully become until a decade later, when Flexner's brother Abraham started the Institute for Advanced Study with Einstein as its first member. But if the setting was bucolic, if crops grew and assorted animals, not simply guinea pigs or rabbits, but cattle, pigs, and horses, grazed only yards from the laboratories, the Rockefeller part of Princeton brewed intensity. Smith was continuing to produce world-class work. Just being around him energized Lewis. For the first time since he left the Rockefeller Institute, he felt at home. Yet he was alone. His wife and children stayed in Philadelphia. He was alone to work, alone to go to the laboratory in the middle of the night, alone with his thoughts. In nearly a year, however, he produced nothing. Flexner and he did discuss his future. He was 45 years old. His next move would likely be his last one. He could still return to the University of Pennsylvania if he chose. He did not so choose, telling Flexner, "I can only repeat that I am free of any entanglement there, even of sentiment." The University of Iowa had also extended its offer once again, and once again raised the salary. But what he wanted was to stay at Rockefeller. He had made little progress on the tuberculosis project he had brought with him from Philadelphia, but, more importantly, he had, he assured himself as much as Flexner, rejuvenated himself. He informed Flexner that, despite the higher salary at Iowa, "my only interest in position is here." Lewis's presence fitted perfectly into Flexner's own plans. Flexner explained, "I have always believed that our departments should not be one-man affairs. In New York, a dozen or more extraordinary investigators led groups of younger researchers, each group working on a major problem. The Princeton location had not developed similarly. Beyond Smith's own operation, it had not filled out." Flexner told Lewis, "Your coming offers the first chance to make a second center there." Further, Smith would turn 65 that year. Flexner and Smith and even Welch hinted to Lewis that he might succeed Smith when he retired. Flexner suggested that Lewis stay one more year under a temporary arrangement, and then they would see. Lewis told Flexner, "I am secure as I never was before." He believed he was home. It would be his last home. If Lewis was going to build a department, he needed a young scientist. Someone with more than just laboratory skills. Someone with ideas. His contacts in Iowa urged him to try a young man they thought would make a mark. Richard Shope was the son of a physician who was also a farmer. He had gotten his medical degree at the University of Iowa, then spent a year teaching pharmacology at the medical school and experimenting on dogs. An outstanding college track athlete, tall, a man's man at ease with himself, something Lewis never quite seemed to be, Shope always maintained contact with the wild, with the forest, with hunting, not only in the laboratory, but with a gun in his hands. His mind had a certain wildness, too, like a small boy playing with a chemistry set, hoping for an explosion. He had more than an inquiring mind. He had an original one. Years later, Thomas Rivers, the virologist who not only succeeded Cole as head of the Rockefeller Institute Hospital, but served as president of four different scientific associations, said, "Dick Shope is one of the finest investigators I have ever seen. A stubborn guy, and he is tough. Dick would no sooner start to work on a problem than he would make a fundamental discovery. It never made one bit of difference where he was." In World War II, Rivers and Shope landed on Guam soon after combat troops secured it. In Okinawa, they would come under fire, to investigate tropical diseases that might threaten soldiers. While there, Shope occupied himself by isolating an agent from a fungus mold that mitigated some viral infections. Ultimately, he was elected to membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Yet even with Shope's help, Lewis's work did not go well. It was not for lack of intelligence on Lewis's part. Shope knew Welch, Flexner, Smith, Avery, and many Nobel laureates well, yet he considered Lewis a notch above. Like Aronson, the prize-winning scientist who had worked at the Pasteur Institute and knew Lewis at Penn, Shope considered Lewis the smartest person he ever met. Lewis had reached some tentative conclusions in Philadelphia about tuberculosis. He believed that three, and possibly four, inherited factors affected the natural ability of guinea pigs to produce antibodies, that is, to resist infection. He had planned to unravel precisely what the nature of these factors was. This was an important question, one that potentially went far beyond tuberculosis to a deep understanding of the immune system. But when he and Shope repeated the Philadelphia experiments, they got different results. They examined every element of the experiments to see what might explain the differences and repeated them again. Then they repeated the process and the experiments again. Again, they got differing results, results from which it was impossible to draw a conclusion. Nothing in science is as damning as the inability of an outside experimenter to reproduce results. Now Lewis himself could not reproduce the results he had gotten in Philadelphia, results he had depended upon. Much less could he build upon and expand them. He had run into a wall. He began plugging away at it. Shope, too, plugged away at it. Both of them had the tenacity to stay after a thing. But they made no progress. More distressing to Smith and Flexner, who watched closely, was the way Lewis was approaching the problem. His failures seemed to confuse him. Unlike Avery, who broke his problems down into smaller ones that could be solved and who learned from each failure, Lewis seemed simply to be applying brute force, huge numbers of experiments. He sought to add other scientists with particular expertise to his team, but he did not define what precise role new people would play. Unlike Avery, who recruited people with specific skills to attack a specific question, Lewis seemed simply to want to throw resources at the problem, hoping someone would solve it. He seemed desperate now. Desperate men can be dangerous and even feared, but they are rarely respected. He was losing their respect, and with that would go everything. As Lewis approached the end of his third year in Princeton, Smith confided his disappointment to Flexner. "He is perhaps aiming higher than his training and equipment warrant, and this results in a demand to surround himself with technically trained chemists, etc. This is what Carell, Alexis Carell at the Rockefeller Institute in New York, who had already received the Nobel Prize, is doing, but Carell has another type of mind and gets results from his organization. A closely knit group requires that the ideas come from the head man." Nor did Lewis seem to recognize as worth pursuing potentially promising side questions his experiments raised. His explanation for his failures, for example, was that the diet of the guinea pigs was different in Princeton than it had been in Philadelphia. This was potentially significant, and it was possible he was correct. The relationship between diet and disease had been noted before, but chiefly in terms of outright diet deficiencies that directly caused such diseases as scurvy and pellagra. Lewis was thinking about far more subtle and indirect linkages between diet and disease, including infectious disease. But instead of pursuing this line of inquiry, Lewis continued to pound away at his old one. He did so without result. He reported to the Board of Scientific Directors, "I have planned no change in my line of work for the coming year." Flexner wanted to hear something different. Lewis was making himself a marked man, marked in no good way. It wasn't Lewis's failures that did so. It was the manner in which he was failing. Dully, without imagination, and without the gain of knowledge elsewhere. Lewis had shown enough, or failed to show enough, that Flexner had already made one judgment. When Smith retired, Lewis would not replace him. Flexner wrote him a chilling letter. In a draft, Flexner was brutal. "There is no obligation expressed or implied in the Institute's relation to you, or your relation to the Institute, beyond this service year period. As the Iowa chair is still open and you are very much wanted to fill it, and the University of Iowa would make a supreme effort to secure you, I believe it due you to be minutely informed just what the position the Board of Scientific Directors has taken with reference to you. There was doubt expressed about your future in general." Flexner did not send that letter. It was too harsh even for him. Instead, he simply informed Lewis that the board was unequivocally opposed to the appointment of one primarily a human pathologist, which Lewis was, to the directorship of the Department of Animal Pathology, and that therefore he would not replace Smith. But he also warned Lewis that the board would not elevate him to the rank of a member of the Institute, the equivalent of a tenured full professor. He would remain only an associate. His appointment expired in 6 months, in mid-1926, and the board would give him a 3-year appointment into 1929. Perhaps he should accept the Iowa offer after all. In Faust, Goethe wrote, "Too old am I to be content with play, too young to live untroubled by desire." Lewis was too old to play, too young to be untroubled by desire. Reading Flexner's letter had to have been a crushing blow. He had expected to be told he would succeed Smith. He had been certain he would be elevated to the rank of member of the Institute. From the laboratory, he drew his identity, and yet now the laboratory gave him not sustenance, but cold rebuff. The two men he most admired in the world, two men he had thought of as scientific fathers, one of whom he regarded as almost a father, had judged that he lacked something. Lacked a thing that would entitle him to join their brotherhood, to become a member. By now, Lewis's family had moved to Princeton, but his marriage was no better. Perhaps the fault lay entirely within him, within what was now not so much a failing ambition as a failing love. He declined the Iowa job once again. He had always been willing to gamble. Now he gambled on proving himself to Flexner and Smith. For the next year and a half, he worked, at first feverishly, but then something in him made him withdraw. His son Hobart, then 14 years old, was having difficulties emotionally and difficulties in school, although a change of schools seemed to help. And Lewis had a car accident that broke his concentration. He accomplished little. Again, his failures were not like those that Avery would confront for nearly a decade. Avery was attacking the most fundamental questions of immunology and, ultimately, genetics. From each failed experiment, he learned. Perhaps not much, but something. And what he was learning went beyond how to fine-tune an experiment. What he was learning from his failures had large ramifications that applied to entire fields of knowledge. One could argue that none of Avery's experiments failed. Lewis was simply foundering. He had spent hour after hour in the laboratory. It had always been his favorite place, his place of rest, of peace. It gave him no peace now. He began to avoid it. His marriage was no better. His wife and he barely communicated. But he found other things to do. Gardening, carpentry, things he had never attended to before. Perhaps he hoped getting away would clear his mind, allow him to see through the fog of data. Perhaps he thought that. But his mind never seemed to go back to the problem. In August 1927, he confessed to Flexner, "I feel I have not been very productive. Certainly I feel that I have had a meager return for a lot of hard work. But some way everything I have touched in the hope it would go faster than the very slow jobs I have been on for so long has either been a washout or turned into some other big problem." Then he said something even more striking. He was no longer going to the laboratory. "I am spending most of my time on an old house and garden I have gotten hold of." Flexner replied, for him, gently. Lewis was now more than a year into his 3-year contract extension. Flexner warned that his tuberculosis work has been underway as your major problem for 4 years. The outcome, even if continued many years longer, is uncertain, and the yield of side issues, often the most fruitful of all, has been small. I do not believe in sticking to a rather barren subject. One of the requisites of an investigator is a kind of instinct which tells him quite as definitely when to drop as well as when to take up a subject. Your time can be more promisingly employed along another major line. Lewis rejected the advice. On September 30th, 1918, J.S. Cohn, a veterinarian with the Federal Bureau of Animal Industry, had been attending the National Swine Breeders Show in Cedar Rapids. Many of the swine were ill, some of them deathly ill. Over the next several weeks, he tracked the spread of the disease, the deaths of thousands of swine, and concluded they had influenza, the same disease killing humans. Farmers attacked his diagnosis. It could cost them money. Nonetheless, a few months later he published his conclusion in the Journal of Veterinary Medicine. Last fall and winter we were confronted with a new condition, if not a new disease. I believe I have as much to support this diagnosis in pigs as the physicians have to support a similar diagnosis in man. The similarity of the epidemic among people and the epidemic among pigs was so close, the reports so frequent, that an outbreak in the family would be followed immediately by an outbreak among the hogs and vice versa, as to present a most striking coincidence, if not suggesting a close relation between the two conditions. The disease had continued to strike swine in the Midwest. In 1922 and 1923, veterinarians at the Bureau of Animal Industry transmitted the disease from pig to pig through mucus from the respiratory tract. They filtered the mucus and tried to transmit the disease with the filtrate. They failed. Shope observed swine influenza during a trip home to Iowa. He began investigating it. Lewis helped him isolate a bacillus virtually identical to B. influenzae and named it B. influenzae suis. Shope also replicated the experiments by the veterinarians and began to move beyond them. He found this work potentially very interesting. Lewis's own work, however, continued to founder. Flexner and Smith had kept their assessments of it confidential. As far as the rest of the world, even including Shope, knew, they held him in the highest regard. In June 1928, for the fourth time, the University of Iowa made Lewis still another offer, an outstanding offer. Flexner urged him to accept. Lewis replied that his compelling interest remained at Princeton. Flexner called Smith to discuss our future Lewis problem. They could not understand him. Lewis had produced nothing in 5 years. They, in fact, did have the highest regard for him, just no longer for his laboratory skills. Flexner still believed that Lewis had true gifts, broad and deep vision, an extraordinary ability to communicate and inspire. Flexner still believed that Lewis could become a dominant figure in medical teaching and research. Of that field, he could still be master. Lewis had shown at least some of what Welch had. Perhaps he had much of it. And perhaps in the end, he also lacked what Welch lacked, the creativity and organizational vision to actually run a major laboratory investigation. 2 days after Flexner and Smith talked, Flexner sat down with Lewis. He was blunt. But he assured Lewis the bluntness was a conclusion placed before you in all kindness. The prospect of Lewis's becoming a member of the Institute was a distant dream. His research had been sterile for the past 5 years. Unless it yielded something solid and important in the next year, he would not be reappointed even to a temporary position. He was approaching 50 years of age, and Flexner told him, "The chances of your changing in the direction of more fertile ideas are small." He also said Lewis had not acted with energy and determination. He had not fought. Then, most painfully, Flexner said he was not essentially of the investigator type. Flexner urged him, indeed all but ordered him, to take the Iowa position. It was an extraordinary offer. $10,000 a year salary, more than double the median income for physicians, and a free hand in organizing a department. Flexner assured him that he still believed he had great gifts. Great gifts. He could still make a huge contribution, a significant and important contribution. At Iowa, he could become a major figure, inspire respect, and be far happier. Lewis listened quietly and said little. He did not remonstrate or argue. He was almost passive, yet firm. There was a cold, unreachable center within him. Regarding Iowa, that was settled. He would reject the offer. He had no interest in anything but the laboratory. He hoped in the next year to justify reappointment. After the conversation, Flexner was frustrated and angry. I put all the pressure I could upon him, but without avail, he wrote Smith. My notion is our obligations to Lewis are now fulfilled, and that unless a great change takes place, it will be our duty to act decisively next spring. He has been a real disappointment to me. I left no doubt as to the risk he takes, and he left me no doubt that he understands and accepts that risk. A few months before Flexner's brutal conversation with Lewis, Hideo Noguchi had gone to Ghana to investigate yellow fever. Noguchi was as close to a pet as Flexner had. They had first met almost 30 years earlier, when Flexner was still at Penn and gave a speech in Tokyo. Uninvited, Noguchi had followed him to Philadelphia, knocked on his door, and announced he had come to work with him. Flexner found a position for him, then took him to the Rockefeller Institute. There, Noguchi had developed an international reputation, but a controversial one. He had done real science with Flexner, for example, identifying and naming neurotoxin in cobra venom. And he had claimed even more significant breakthroughs on his own, including the ability to grow polio and rabies viruses. He could not have grown them with his techniques. Rivers, also at Rockefeller and the first person to demonstrate that viruses were parasites on living cells, questioned those claims. Noguchi responded by telling him that a man who had done